And welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Angeli. This hour on the program, we'll look back at the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the president who helped move the country out of the Great Depression and who led America's military effort in World War II as commander-in-chief. My guest this hour is FDR biographer Gene Edward Smith. He says it's high time that FDR be revisited. More than 60 years after his death, he says the Depression, World War II, the New Deal, these are fading memories. The extent to which the United States was threatened, the national sacrifice required, he says, forgotten. So it's time, my guest says, to recall that cheerful man who could not walk, who could not stand unassisted, yet who remained serenely confident as he guided the nation into a peaceful and prosperous future. Gene Edward Smith is professor of political science at Marshall University. His biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, now in paperback, is titled simply FDR. Welcome, Gene Smith, to Open Line. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
And we're at 614-292-8513. Gene, you say it's time we remember this man and his accomplishments and the time. You think it is fading from our memories, eh?
Oh, I believe it is. And I think that each major historical figure needs to be revisited, Lincoln and Washington and Grant, as a new generation comes on board.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about America's spirit and the economic conditions in America when Roosevelt assumed the presidency.
Well, I think we're living in an entirely different time now. For the last generation or so, Americans have been told that government is the problem and not the solution. And this has led to privatization of vital government functions, to the appointment of regulatory commissions of members who are at odds with the regulations they're entrusted to enforce. I think when we look back at FDR's time, we see how differently Americans viewed government and the president. They assumed government would serve people and solve problems, and they trusted the president much more than we do today.
Mm-hmm. You see, when he took office in 1933, a third of the nation, a third, was unemployed. So agriculture lay destitute, factories were idle, businesses were closing their doors, and the banking system was on the brink of collapse. Quite a situation. So when FDR took office, what was among the first things that he did? You say he inspired confidence with an inaugural address that ranks right up there with Lincoln's second inaugural.
Well, yes, indeed, and he hit the ground running. The first thing he did was really to salvage the American banking system. He declared a banking holiday, closing the banks to restore depositor confidence. The strong banks were reopened quickly. The weak ones were consolidated. With his first fireside chat, he explained to the nation what the crisis was about, and that indeed restored depositor confidence within a week. After that, he really, other than saving the banking system, had no precise schedule of march. He responded pragmatically as the issues came forward. And the next one was agriculture,
mm-hmm.
Almost half the nation's farmers face foreclosure. And he responded with the Farm Credit Administration. Farm mortgages were refinanced. Production credit that was provided at low interest rates. Acreage allotments, production was placed under control, and a network of county agents was established, which brought the latest scientific devices and soil testing to every county in the country.
None of this had existed prior.
That's correct.
Yeah. Well, he was faced with a third of the nation unemployed. What did he do at first?
Well, yes, and he tackled that with a series of agencies, beginning his own idea, the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC, which put young men to work reforesting the country ecological projects that were designed to restore the nation's basic structure.
Mm-hmm.
He established then a series of agencies to put people to work. The WPA, the PWA, the CWA, all of which were public works agencies employing a vast number of people. What he did not do is to put people on the dole, to put people on unemployment compensation.
Mm-hmm.
He provided work which not only restored the nation's sagging infrastructure, but it gave people confidence and restored their opinion of themselves.
Gene, when you look at the various, the CCC, the WPA, PWA, et cetera, what, how many people total were employed in all of these programs?
Oh gosh, off the top of my head, I can't give you an estimate, but I would say close to 20 million.
20 million people employed essentially by the government, and we still see the results of their work today, right?
Oh, absolutely. Here in Huntington, West Virginia, for example, the streets were paved with bricks. Now, the paving streets with bricks doesn't seem to be a very cost-efficient idea, but by laying bricks, you employ an awful lot of people.
Well, you know, you say, you quote FDR, his principle apparently, he said, modern society acting through its government owes the definite obligation to prevent the starvation or the dire want of any of its fellow men and women who try to maintain themselves but cannot. Now, is this something you said very early in his presidency? When did he say that?
Well, he said this when he was governor of New York, actually.
Ah.
He was governor of New York when the Depression hit. And he was the first state chief executive to take action to combat the Depression and the unemployment situation, which he did as governor. And many of those policies, the CWA, for example, and the CCC were both continuations of those policies that he'd initiated in New York. And in fact, he brought down Harry Hopkins from New York, who had run the program there, to Washington to do the same.
Was this an unusual philosophy for somebody in government at the time?
Well, yes, indeed. It was breathtaking because before that, we had lived with what economists call the night watchman's fate. The involvement of the government in the economy was absolutely unprecedented.
Hmm. Well, there must have been a lot of opposition to this, I would think.
Well, yes and no. There was initially virtually no opposition because the country was so destitute that whatever Roosevelt asks for during the first 100 days that Congress met, he received without question the authorization to close the nation's banks. The banking bill was passed without really having a printed copy before the House.
Mm-hmm.
So initially during those first 100 days, the country and those in the Congress were perfectly prepared to accept what Roosevelt had done. The problem came later, and since this was so unprecedented, Roosevelt was swimming upstream against a host of constitutional precedent that held against government's involvement in the economy, and that's where he ran into trouble with the Hughes Court.
Mm-hmm. Give me an example of that, if you could.
Well, the National Industrial Recovery Act, the NIRA, which established a network of labor management committees to control production and control prices, was declared unconstitutional by the court in United States versus Schechter Poultry Company. His attempt to regulate the prices in the bituminous coal industry was overturned in Carter versus Carter Coal Company. The precedents before that went back to the old Hammer versus Dagenhardt case, where the Supreme Court held that the government could not regulate child labor. And in Lochner versus New York, they held that state governments had no power to set wages and regulate hours. Those precedents were there, and the legislation was drafted so quickly that it didn't take adequate notice of those precedents and try to skirt them.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Gene Edward Smith. He's professor of political science at Marshall University. His biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt is the winner of the Francis Parkman Prize, and it is now available in paperback. It's entitled simply FDR. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email a question or comment to openline@wosu.org. Gene, back a little to some of these programs that got everybody employed. There are 20 million Americans approximately anyway employed. The Civilian Conservation Corps, you know, working on national parks and working on natural mm-hmm. areas. Remind us, as you say, this is fading from our memories. Remind us of what some of these programs did. Let's talk about the WPA for a minute. How did that employ people?
Yes, the CCC. Let me try to sketch the where each fit in. The CCC was directed toward young men. Period. The PWA was a standard public works program headed by Secretary Ickes in the Department of Interior, which was designed to build major public works, dams, buildings, and so. But the WPA was really a project simply to put people to work doing what would be useful in their community. Right. And Harry Hopkins headed that. And I mentioned the paving the streets with bricks in Huntington. To provide work, to provide pay, but not necessarily to create major public structures as the PWA did. And it also was aimed at not only at unemployed workers, it was aimed at employing writers and artists. Many of our post offices are decorated with murals that were painted by artists under the WPA. Many of our writers, John Cheever, Richard Wright, worked and wrote for the I don't want to say wrote for the WPA, but wrote under the and were paid by the WPA for writing books and articles themselves.
In other words, were some writers paid simply for were they paid for writing short stories or novels?
Yes, they were paid for writing short stories and novels. Harry Hopkins said writers have to live too.
My goodness, and of course, I think they, that writers under the WPA produced a series of travel guides, essentially, to all the states. Is that right?
Well, they're more than travel guides. These are hardbound books of usually about 400 or 500 pages, which are definitive guides to the book. I think I would travel guide trivializes it. I'm afraid a bit. These were guides to books to Mississippi, to West Virginia, to Washington D.C., to Ohio, and these are standard works which are still consulted.
Sculptors made public sculptures, did they? Did sculptors?
Oh yes, I mean sculptors like artists were employed in special programs as well. In other words, Hopkins did not simply take writers and artists and sculptors who needed a paycheck and put them out paving the streets of Huntington with bricks.
Mm-hmm. Remind us who Harry Hopkins was.
Second.
Remind us who Harry Hopkins was.
Harry Hopkins was a young man from Iowa who was a social worker in New York. Roosevelt named him the deputy head of the relief agency he established in New York, and then he became head of that during Roosevelt's last year in government. And then he came to Washington, led the WPA, led the relief efforts of the Roosevelt administration, and remained with Roosevelt throughout his life.
Mm-hmm.
He was very close. He lived in the White House for a while, and essentially he took the place of Louis Howe, who died in 1934, and Howe had been Roosevelt's principal political advisor throughout his political career.
Mm-hmm. We're at 614-292-8513. Gene Edward Smith with us. His current biography, FDR, is now in paperback. Charlotte is on the line. Hi, Charlotte.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if Roosevelt's policies didn't grow out of a confluence created by necessity. On one hand, you have the old Judeo-Christian ethic that the highest order of charity is to give a man a job so he need not become a burden on the community. One thinks of Maimonides back in the 9th century. And then with the rise of Keynesian economics, that with your banking system basically on its knees, you had to get the money moving somewhere to stimulate the economy somehow, and that government spending was the alternative in the face of private collapse.
Well, yes, you hit the nail on the head, and that's exactly right. And Roosevelt's big concern was not simply to pay people for doing nothing. He felt that that was injurious to their self-worth, and the idea of pump priming really first expressed itself in the United States at that time. It's become so ingrained in our society that we're just in the midst of a stimulation effort by the United States government. Roosevelt, instead of simply mailing checks to people, insisted that there be a quid pro quo.
Okay, Charlotte.
And his own class never forgave him for it.
Say again?
His own class never forgave him for it.
Well, some did. So curiously, the Morgan Bank was very much on Roosevelt's side all through this. But you're quite right, some did not.
Thank you.
Charlotte, thanks for your call. Gina, as Charlotte pointed out, Roosevelt was very wealthy and came from a very wealthy family. And so the question has been asked, coming from such enormous wealth, how did he come about this feeling that he had this empathy for those who were much less fortunate? How do we trace that development?
Well, Roosevelt, to begin with, was a natural political animal. But I think the decisive event was polio, which caused him to recognize the nature of suffering and to find sources of strength within himself, but particularly because to recover from polio, he went year after year to Warm Springs, Georgia. And I don't know if you know Warm Springs, but this is in a poverty-stricken area of Georgia, and all around him he saw hardworking people who simply could not make a living. Mm-hmm. And this made an enormous impression on him. It was also good politics.
Yeah. Tell me about it being good politics.
Well, Roosevelt cast his net widely. The Democratic Party, up until FDR, had really been a fairly conservative party. And Al Smith and John Jacob Raskob, the party chairman, all of Roosevelt's competitors for the Democratic nomination in 1932 represented the old Grover Cleveland hard money element in the Democratic Party, and it was Roosevelt who reached out to what he called the forgotten man and engendered great criticism from the Democratic Party establishment at the time for reaching out to this new class of voters, mobilizing them and bringing them into the political arena.
Mm-hmm. You say the forgotten man. I mean, these were those, the working class?
Those at the bottom of the economic pyramid.
Mm-hmm. And now that's almost the definition in some ways of the Democratic Party, that they would reach out to that class?
Roosevelt is the first who did.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not, I mean, and initially to poor white workers and then stitching together that what we call the Roosevelt Coalition, which included minorities and immigrants, which previously had really had no place to go.
You know, Gene, you write that FDR, the consummate politician, that he knew the Democratic Party thoroughly, including local officials around the country. I mean, he knew them by name. Huh?
Well, yes, he did. There's a famous old story that which is not apocryphal. That Roosevelt could take a map of the United States and a straight-edge ruler and draw a line from the Atlantic to the Pacific and tell you every county the line intersected and the name of the party chairman in that county. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of the Democratic Party, which really began in 1920 when he was the vice presidential candidate under Governor Cox of Ohio. And he traveled the country at that time widely, and all during the 1920s, he kept up a voluminous correspondence with political leaders all over the country. So, yes, he knew it like the back of his hand.
So if you had to name a president who was the consummate politician of the 20th century, I guess that would be FDR, no exception.
Oh, there's no question. Or
yeah.
Actually, in that respect, or of the 18th or 19th.
Really? He says we had an enormous appetite for this kind of activity. I mean, this was his vocation, clearly, to be a politician.
It was his vocation. It was his avocation. It was perfectly natural to him, and he spent the last 13 years of his life as president of the United States.
You know, there's something indefinable here, too, in addition to the, you know, the WPA and the CCC and the bank holiday and all those things. There was something about him. You write he radiated this kind of assurance and confidence, a kind of buoyant energy and an unshakable optimism. And I guess that came across to people. Huh?
Well, it did. And it really made you forget that he was crippled. There have been some revisionism of commentators suggesting that the White House attempted to conceal the fact that he was crippled. That's entirely not true. News photographers never took any photographs of him being carried about or that would emphasize the fact that he was a cripple. because they felt that it was irrelevant, that his dynamism and decisiveness just seemed to make that something that wasn't worth that wasn't newsworthy. And but my goodness, I'm 75 years old, and we all knew the president was crippled. That's why we brought dimes to school on his birthday every January 30th of the March of Dimes.
So everybody knew that.
Oh yes.
Did the photographers refrain from taking those pictures? You say what they felt it wasn't newsworthy. Of course, today you know what they would be doing. They'd be taking close-ups.
That's true. People's private lives were much more public figures' private lives were much more private in those days. The press respected that, but I also think it was a feeling that it was irrelevant. That it gave the wrong impression of Roosevelt. And of course, all of the newsmen were very much on FDR's side.
So the American people knew this as well, and what's encouraging is that it was irrelevant to the American people.
I think, yes, it was certainly irrelevant. He was elected four times because his actions, his activity, his dynamism made you simply forget the fact that he was crippled.
You trace some of that confidence and that self-assurance perhaps back to his upbringing and his mother, Sarah, who gave him not only the wealth that she gave him so that he could free himself from political activity, but also, the full confidence, emotional support, et cetera, et cetera.
There's no question of that. Sarah transmitted to him the confidence that characterized his presidency. Sarah was a Delano, and the Delanos looked down on the Roosevelts. Seven of Sarah's ancestors landed on the Mayflower. That's an awfully high percentage. Sarah's father made a fortune in China in the 1840s selling tea, and then a larger fortune in China in the 1860s in the opium trades. And they were immensely wealthy. Franklin was an only child. He was surrounded by maternal warmth and devotion, and Sarah transmitted the confidence of the Delanos to him. She often said, in fact, that my son Franklin is not a Roosevelt at all. He's a Delano.
And what did she mean by that?
Well, that the Roosevelts, the Hudson River Roosevelts, not the TR strain, but the Hudson River strain, were very cautious retiring men who really did not enter public life, who all of whom married well and simply husbanded their money and lived relatively bucolic lives on the Hudson River.
So genetically, he was a Delano, at least in his mother's opinion, anyway.
And attitudinally, in her view, yes.
Attitudinally. Well, FDR is the book by my guest, Gene Edward Smith, who is professor of political science at Marshall University. It's now out in a paperback edition, by the way. American Experience on WOSU TV 34 at 9 o'clock tonight is a part two we are showing of the FDR TV series, unrelated to the book, as a matter of fact, but the FDR television series. Is showing in its part two tonight on WOSU TV 34 at 9 o'clock. Very interesting. We're going to pause here with my guest, Gene Edward Smith, and we'll be back to talk more about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the New Deal, and the war after we pause for these messages at WOSU 820, NPR News.
Everybody's an expert on their own lives. And on Talk of the Nation, we ask you to share your stories.
These techniques were used on me when I went through resistance training, sleep deprivation, putting bags over our heads.
I'm Neil Conan. Real stories from real people about real issues that matter to you. Join us. Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It's 56 degrees at 10:30. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Your membership with WOSU provides for the news and information you rely on. And in this pivotal election year, your support is more important than ever. Becoming a member is easy when you go online to wosu.org/give. And thank you for your continued support of WOSU 820, NPR News. Don't forget that weekday mornings, you can prepare for the day with Morning Edition, starting at 5 a.m., now on WOSU 89.7 FM. In the weather forecast for today, mostly sunny this morning. A few clouds roll in later this afternoon, a high of 65. Mostly cloudy tonight with a chance of rain after midnight, a low of 42. And then cloudy on Tuesday, a chance of morning rain, then becoming sunny in the afternoon, a high of 65. And now back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. A look back this hour at the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the president who, as we know, helped move the country out of the Great Depression, led America's military effort in World War II as commander-in-chief. Gene Edward Smith is professor of political science at Marshall University. His biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, now in paperback, titled simply FDR. We're at 614-292-8513. If you got a comment or question, you can also email to openline at wosu.org. David is on the phone. Hello, David.
Yes, I wanted to tell you about when I was 10 years old in 1940, and we were all involved in the campaign. I'm not sure the kids are today. And when we get on the playground, the three of us, one was from the other side of the tracks, and the fellow was one of the kids was a father was a day laborer, and my father taught at Ohio State. And we would yell, Roosevelt, 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 and all the other kids would be out there yelling, Wilkie, Wilkie, Wilkie. And I went home and said to Mom, there's no way that Roosevelt can win. And then she said to me, oh, yes, he's going to win. Then I woke up the day after election, and I said, Mom, you were right. I was really impressed with Roosevelt, and, of course, was loyal to him in 44 when I was at Camp Wilson, and we had an argument, and I, of course, defended Roosevelt, mm-hmm. and et cetera. I just am concerned that young people today, I don't think, are as involved in the elections process.
Well, it sounds like you were and your friends are involved at a very young age.
Yes.
I think that back to the 1940 election, that's the one presidential election that Roosevelt worried about. He was seriously worried about Wilkie as an opponent, and he remained worried for the first 2 hours that evening as the results came in. But on election day, but then it was clear that the big states were breaking for him, and that he was going to be elected to a third term. The third term issue was also a big problem for him in that campaign.
Mm-hmm.
About young people today, I think. I think the comment is quite true, but I think that Senator Obama, by his track record thus far, is certainly mobilizing a generation of voters that have ignored the process until now.
Mm-hmm. David, thanks for your call, 614-292-8513. Gene, we were talking during the break, and you mentioned that FDR was masterful at handling the press. How many press conferences did he have?
He had 999 during his 13 years in office, and from the very first week, he set up a policy of meeting the press twice a week. He met them on Wednesdays and Fridays, and he met them in the Oval Office while sitting at his desk, and the White House press corps simply all came into the Oval Office and stood around his desk, and they could ask him anything he wanted. He knew most of the reporters by their first names. In fact, at that first press conference, he shook hands with each one of them. He really saw them as part of the New Deal, as part of the administration, and they could ask whatever they wanted. He was joking. He was friendly with them. If he didn't want to answer a question, he would simply tell them that he was not going to answer it. But these were really free free-flowing sessions, and of course. The press indeed felt often that they were being made part of the administration.
And they didn't seem to resent that for the most part.
Some did, but not many. Mm-hmm. Most of them were on board, and he was very popular. He was a very likable person.
Now, in terms of the war, you say he nudged the American people. He nudged the nation toward a war footing. Tell me about that.
Well, yes. There's a very interesting letter from King George VI to Roosevelt, who said, "I have admired the way you have led public opinion by allowing it to get ahead of you." Roosevelt carefully played public opinion. For example, in 1939, he invited King George VI and Queen Elizabeth to the United States for the World Fair. They're the first British monarchs to visit the United States, and that in itself helped to cement relations with Great Britain. It's that type of nudging that I mean. In World War I, when it began, Woodrow Wilson said that the United States must be neutral in thought as well as in deed. Roosevelt took no. That was not Roosevelt's idea. Roosevelt felt that we were clearly on the side of the Western democracies, that Hitler and Mussolini were our enemies, and never made any bones about that.
Mm-hmm. Prior to the attack at Pearl Harbor, what was Roosevelt's thinking about our allies in Europe, the need to come to their aid? I mean, how did he conceptualize the threat to the United States and the need to be a firm ally?
Well, he saw Hitler and Nazi Germany as an extreme menace to civilization. And after the fall of France, he recognized that Britain had to be supported and provided 50 destroyers, American destroyers, to Great Britain in exchange for base rights in the Atlantic. He sponsored a peacetime draft, the first in American history. He was very fortunate that Wendell Willkie agreed with him on both those points, so they didn't become an issue in the 1940 election.
But there were isolationists, right, who did not want to get involved in this war.
Yes, but that battle, curiously, was fought in the Republican Convention. Uh-huh. And when Willkie got the nomination, that was no longer an issue. And Lend-Lease, for example, which is a principal program of that era, Roosevelt devised it after the 1940 election. Roosevelt himself, while cruising on the USS Tuscaloosa in the Caribbean, and came up with the idea of Lend-Lease. This wasn't something that bubbled up through the bureaucracy.
And how did Lend-Lease work?
We gave weapons and whatever else they needed to Great Britain and later to the Soviet Union without expecting any money to be in return.
Because Britain at that point maybe didn't have the money to give.
Well, the American policy up until Lend-Lease had been just cash on the barrelhead.
Yeah.
And the British were broke, and the Russians were broke.
But, Gene, was their isolationist opinion a significant amount among the American people?
It depends on the part of the country. Certainly not on the East Coast and the West Coast. In between, it was considerable, particularly where you had a large German population or a large Italian population. Mm-hmm. It was a serious concern, but one of the good things that the Southerners who left Roosevelt, Southern congressmen and senators in the second term, all came back when it looked like war. And curiously, the progressives, many of the progressives who were isolationists, left the New Deal. Mm-hmm. That's why Roosevelt had to be very cautious in how he nudged the U.S. toward war.
Gina, the preface to FDR, you write, "What Roosevelt did not do is to connive with the Japanese in the attack on Pearl Harbor." Why do you feel it's necessary to say that?
Well, because there's been conspiracy theorists over the years have suggested that the United States was complicit in the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Because it is extraordinary that the Japanese were able to do that much damage that quickly with that much accuracy. But in the first place, I think we don't give Admiral Yamamoto and the Japanese Navy sufficient credit for what was indeed a truly extraordinary achievement. But there is no evidence whatsoever that the president or the administration knew that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor. Now, FDR's concern in Europe caused him to neglect the situation in the Pacific. It deteriorated significantly in 1941. The United States cut off oil supplies to Japan, which was really pushing the Japanese toward war. Roosevelt, in fact, was blindsided by his own administration on that. And I think by December it would be fair to say that the United States recognized that the Japanese might attack in December because of that oil situation. But they thought that the attack was going to be in Indonesia, in Burma, in Malaya, in the Philippines perhaps. But no, everyone assumed that Pearl Harbor was impregnable.
That's interesting. In other words, we cut off their oil supply, at least from us, and so we understood that there would probably be some attack in response to that. That was a mortal blow directed at the Japanese.
Yes, and I say Roosevelt was blindsided on that. Roosevelt had always refused to do that. Dean Acheson, who was Assistant Secretary of State, issued the order to do that while Roosevelt was meeting with Churchill up off Newfoundland at the Atlantic Charter Conference.
Why was Pearl Harbor felt to be impregnable? I mean, why would it?
Oh well, look, it was 5,000 miles from the Japanese home islands to send aircraft carriers all across the Pacific refueling the ships in the convoy daily. It was just seemed to be an unachievable naval incident.
Mm-hmm. But they were able to pull it off.
Yes, and as I say, we did not give Admiral Yamamoto. Who really didn't have his heart in it, but we did not really give Admiral Yamamoto sufficient credit for mounting this.
Gene Edward Smith is professor of political science at Marshall University. His biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, now in paperback, is titled simply FDR. Let's go to our phone, 614-292-8513. You can email to openline@wosu.org. And here's Jeff. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Good morning. Professor, can you tell us what Roosevelt knew about the Holocaust, how soon he knew and how soon he took action?
Yes. Insofar as the treatment of Germany's Jewish population, beginning with Kristallnacht in 39, Roosevelt withdrew, recalled the American ambassador. His hands, insofar as immigration is concerned, we have to remember that his hands were tied by the National Origins Act of 1924, which really restricted immigration into the United States. And also there was no real groundswell of opinion that wanted to admit more immigrants. This was a time of scattered unemployment. Labor was not interested in it. Curiously, neither the religious nor the academic communities made any effort to increase the amount of immigration. But insofar as the German concentration camps and the death camps are concerned, Roosevelt learned about it in late 1943 and 44. And I think it is fair to say that the American diplomatic establishment, the State Department in particular, was not at all sympathetic to the plight of European Jewry. The president, on the other hand, was. And when Rabbi Weiss called to his attention the death camps, he issued a blistering warning to the Germans that they would be punished for this after the war. It was front page news in the New York Times, and it's really the basis that was for the Nuremberg trials that took place afterwards. So I think it's fair to say he was very concerned about it, but there was really very little he could do. Roosevelt's opinion was that the best way to save European Jewry was to defeat Hitler as quickly as possible.
Why did he come so late to this knowledge? Is it 43, 44?
It really didn't. Well, actually, don't forget the Wannsee Conference is what, 41, 42, and so the extermination really didn't begin until just shortly before that, and the diplomatic information that he received, diplomats in Europe at first were skeptical because remembering World War One and the British propaganda about Germans bayoneting babies and so forth, they were at first very skeptical and took at face value the fact that the Jewish population was simply being moved east to build roads for the German army.
Hmm. They felt that that was more likely what was going on, at least as far as they could
figure out. It's Rabbi Weiss, who was a close friend of the president's, who met with the president with a group of Jewish leaders and who convinced him and Secretary Morgenthau that this was the case. And the American response was very critical.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, do you have a follow-up question here?
No, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for your call. Gene, you say the State Department was not sympathetic to the plight of European Jewry. Is that because of anti-Semitism?
I'm sorry.
You say the State Department was not sympathetic.
Anti-Semitism permeated the career foreign service. It also permeated the career military, pre-war military. Today we live in a much more tolerant society, and it's difficult when we look back to recognize how vicious and how widely spread at very high levels anti-Semitism and racism and xenophobia were in the United States.
Mm. So you see, the religious community was among others was not pressing to admit Jews who were fleeing.
They were sitting on their hands. But that issue of racial prejudice, one of the reasons for Pearl Harbor is that we totally underestimated the Japanese, and our prejudices against Orientals was a part of that as well.
Mm-hmm. You write, though, you say FDR did not rush to admit the victims of fascism to America's shores.
Yes, I say that. But there was really little that he could do. Given the Immigration Act, he did what he could, but he did not make it a public crusade. I think that was what I was trying to suggest.
Mm-hmm. I wonder why he didn't.
I think he would not have won. I think it would have been very difficult. He did what he could do within the confines of the existing structure, but I think that would have not found much resonance in the country.
Hmm. Sometimes, you know, you might undertake a crusade. You know, you might not win it, but you
well,
might do it anyway because it's the right thing to do.
The Roosevelts were a marvelous team because that was Mrs. Roosevelt's part of the partnership. Mm-hmm. She could undertake those causes that the president couldn't, both in terms of racial equality and in terms of immigration and Hitler's treatment of the Jews.
You say that FDR ignored racial segregation.
Yes, he did.
How so?
He said nothing about racial segregation during the entire 13 years that he was in office because he was beholden to the votes of the White South. Don't forget, African-Americans were not voting in large numbers and certainly not at all in the White South. And he needed the votes of the white committee chairman in both the House and the Senate, who were with almost without exception from the elected by white electorates in the Deep South. And he needed the electoral votes of the old 11 states of the Confederacy, again, where blacks weren't voting. So Roosevelt didn't go there, but he encouraged and supported Mrs. Roosevelt, who was really in the vanguard of the struggle for racial equality.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the women in his life. We've talked about his mother, Sarah, who gave him the money he needed to devote his life to politics and gave him the emotional support he needed to become a confident adult. How about Eleanor Roosevelt? Apparently not a good match in many ways.
It's hard to say. They were very much in love. Roosevelt married her on St. Patrick's Day in 1905, and they had six children, one of whom died in infancy. But Mrs. Roosevelt was a public person very much, and I mentioned her crusade for racial equality. She did not have the maternal gene, and she wasn't very much interested in that home life. And I think it would also be fair to say that she was not a particularly warm or affectionate person. I don't mean to denigrate the great contribution she made. And in 1915 and so on, Roosevelt became infatuated with Lucy Mercer, who was from a prominent Maryland family and who was working as Eleanor's social secretary at the time. And they had an affair that Eleanor found out about it late in 1918, which was devastating to her.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, she and Franklin never really lived together as man and wife in that sense.
There was a bargain they struck, is that right?
Yes, that's right. It was a partnership. They stayed together because of the children, because of Franklin's career. And Sarah insisted that they stay together. And so they stayed together. They They cared very much for each other's happiness, but recognized their own inability to provide for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they cut each other a lot of slack. They each traveled with their own separate entourage. Their paths rarely intersected except at the formal level. But they shared an ongoing affection for many years throughout the president's life. And Mrs. Roosevelt later became a prominent figure in her own right.
Surely. But Lucy Mercer was his true love.
Lucy Mercer was his true love. He did not see her after 1919 when they broke off. She attended, but they kept in contact and in letters. But the letters, which have just been made available, were not mushy letters. They were simply keeping in touch letters. And she attended each of his inaugurations. But when her husband died in 1941, she came back into the president's life and was regularly invited to the White House by the president's daughter, who felt that the president needed that company. And you may know she was with Roosevelt when he died at Warm Springs in April 1945.
Yes. Another woman we want to talk about, very influential or at least strongly connected with FDR, was his personal secretary, Missy LaHand.
Absolutely.
Right? You point out he left half of his estate to her, although she had passed away and never knew that.
That's correct. Missy joined his staff in 1920 as a young woman when he was running for vice president. She stayed with him until she had a stroke in 1941. And she was really his constant companion. When he went cruising off the Florida coast, it was Missy who went with him. When he went to Warm Springs, it was Missy. Missy was with him every day of his life after that. She was a surrogate both for Eleanor and for Lucy. And curiously, neither Eleanor nor Sarah objected to it. I mean, she filled that emotional need that Roosevelt had.
Mm-hmm. Romantic relationship or no?
They were certainly very, on her part, she certainly was in love with the president.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly cared for her company more than anyone else. And the fact that, as you mentioned, in his will, he left her half of his estate. And then after he died, he refused to change the will.
Uh-huh.
James, his eldest son, who was the executor, said, Father, why don't you take this out of the will about Missy? It's going to annoy Mother. And Roosevelt said, no, leave it in.
Wow. FDR is the book by Jean Edward Smith, a professor of political science at Marshall University. Let's go back to our phones. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Your talk is very interesting today, and I have another question I wanted to ask you about. I saw the movie Flags of Our Fathers, and one of the things that surprised me a little bit was that one of the sort of sub-themes in that movie was that, I guess this was in 1944, and the war effort was kind of in trouble. They were in trouble for money, and one of the reasons they wanted to take the pictures of Iwo Jima was to get people enthused about buying war bonds again. And I wondered if you could tell me, in this war, in the Iraq War, you know, the American people haven't been asked to sacrifice anything. What other kind of things besides war bonds and rationing, what kind of things did Roosevelt, encourage? What did he do to raise money for World War II and to get the United States people behind it?
Yeah, Gene, you say we have forgotten the national sacrifice involved here.
Well, that's right. The savings bonds program was a very important aspect, which got ordinary Americans involved in contributing to the war effort, and also which drained off a lot of excess purchasing power that would have contributed to inflation. But we had price control in those days. The Office of Price Administration fixed prices of all goods in American society, so there really was no inflation. The draft, of course, was which ultimately drafted over 12 million young men for the service, certainly made it evident that the scrap drives, which we participated in, was another way. Rationing was very, very important, particularly gas rationing, which was designed primarily to save rubber. Gas rationing brought home to every American that we were in a very serious conflict. sports activities were curtailed to some degree. Major League Baseball continued, but it continued with essentially minor league players who were not physically able to be drafted. There were no draft deferments, by the way. That's another point, perhaps. There were no draft deferments in World War II. College students, athletes, and so forth, there simply were no deferments. Everyone was required to serve, which really made this a people's war and spread the burden around equally. Our army in Iraq is a professional army, and they are paid apparently well for doing that, but it doesn't really make much of an impression on society itself.
But you certainly couldn't say that during World War II. Everybody...
Absolutely. We had air raid, believe it or not. We actually had air raid drills, which I think were primarily designed to make people conscious of the fact that we were in war. But if I could just sort of run with that question in a little different direction.
Yes.
Roosevelt, as commander-in-chief, had an extraordinarily effective capacity for picking the right people and putting them in the right jobs. That's a problem Lincoln never solved until he finally found Grant. But on the eve of the Republican convention, Roosevelt reached out to the Republican Party, made Henry Stimson Secretary of State and Frank Knox Secretary of the Navy. Those were the two most important wartime positions, really. And Stimson had been Secretary of State under Herbert Hoover, Secretary of War under William Howard Taft. Frank Knox had been Alf Landon's running mate for vice president in 1936. So Roosevelt picked two very prominent Republicans on the eve of the Republican convention and brought them into his administration. George Marshall, another example, he reached way down in the Army seniority roster to make Marshall chief of staff. And Marshall was brilliant in that position. To lead the invasion of Europe, he passed over Marshall and named Eisenhower, who had a phenomenal capacity for getting along with the British and the Canadians and the French. So he had that knack of picking the right people. You mentioned, your caller mentioned Flags of Our Fathers about the war in the Pacific. Roosevelt, over the objections of the War Department, recalled MacArthur to active duty in 1941 and gave him command in the Pacific Theater. Another example of is choosing someone who was certainly a political enemy, but whom Roosevelt respected.
And you would say he was also... as commander-in-chief, not a micromanager, which worked to the aid of the war effort, huh?
Well, that's right. That's right. Roosevelt really wished that the United States could land in North Africa before the elections in November 1942, but he'd never pressed Marshall to do so. And the landings took place after the congressional elections, and the Democrats lost heavily.
You know, we just have – sorry, call. There's no more time for any calls, but we just have 2 minutes left. Gene, you know, I've seen newsreel footage of upon Roosevelt's death, just people in tears and out in the streets. And I guess an incredible emotional connection with his president. Huh?
Yes, I don't think the country experienced anything like that had experienced anything like that since Lincoln's death, since Lincoln's assassination. And you might say that – briefly, the outpouring of grief at John Kennedy's assassination.
Yes.
But those two were very sudden events. Roosevelt's health had been failing, but you're quite right. People felt that they had lost a close friend.
Hmm. He was able somehow, the way he spoke to people in the fireside chats, the way they got to know him, I guess, in newsreels. I mean, however, and for some, I guess, he was the only president they'd known in their adult lives.
Well, that's true. Churchill was a great orator, but he didn't speak to the people his audience as individuals. He spoke to the crowd. Roosevelt spoke to each person in the audience, and he was also a great speaker, but they had entirely different styles.
Mm-hmm. Well, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Gene, we're happy to have you here today because, as you say, more than 60 years after his death, some of these memories are fading. And I want to tell you that the book, of course, is the Francis Parkman Prize winner, the national bestseller now in paperback by Gene Edward Smith, who is professor of political science at Marshall University. It's simply entitled FDR. Gene, thanks so very much for being with us this
hour. Thank you very much. My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll find out about the best restaurants in Columbus and Central Ohio with a restaurant critics on this. Supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer. In partnership with the Nature Conservancy, Meijer is helping customers identify and select non-invasive plants for Ohio backyards. Information is available at nature.meijer.com.